The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, if this weekend's top flight action taught us anything, it's that if you think you know what's coming in the J-League, think again. We have the world's most unpredictable league and you've got to love it.
Oh, absolutely. I was very glad of the league on this weekend, of all weekends, given what's going on over in Europe and my club over here, brandishing me a legacy fan. So, yeah, it was great to have the J-League and its unpredictable best.
All right, yes, indeed. And so to join us to wrap up the weekend's J1 Match Day 10 action, along with some other wider issues across football in Japan, it's our pleasure to welcome Dan Orlowitz from the Japan Times back to the pod. Dan, how are you?
I'm good, Ben, Sam. I'm just basking in this rich, rich content vein that we have mined. What a week it is to be involved in the sport, isn't it?
Most definitely. And yes, Dan, of course, fresh off an appearance on the Abroad in Japan podcast, which was a very enjoyable listen, and suggest you check it out. Listeners, that special episode featuring Dan and Mark Pickering. Very enjoyable episode, and great stuff. So, Dan, yeah, we do have some wider issues to touch on before we get on to the action on the pitch over the weekend. Since Sam and I recorded last week's episode, we had another COVID scare at Kashiwa Reysol, although thankfully this time it wasn't quite as serious as what happened last year.
Yes, that's correct. They reported midweek that they had four positive cases among the players. I believe they had one, and then they tested everyone, and they found three more. One case was symptomatic. The others were fortunately asymptomatic. After that, they did repeat testing and contact tracing, and they were able to put a squad together to play at Oita Trinidad and won. So, fortunately, it wasn't a situation like with the Levain Cup last year where they had to postpone the final, and got lucky with this one, fortunately, but it does show how difficult it is for clubs to stay on top of things in these pandemic times.
As you've both kind of mentioned there, this is the second sort of occasion for Kashiwa. Are they at risk at all of any sort of sanctions, or are they allowed to just, okay, this is just another one of those things?
I don't believe they're at risk of sanctions. It is not necessarily certain that the club was negligent in how they handled things. Certainly they've been more vigilant since that cluster in late October, early November. We still don't know exactly how these players were infected. They have to figure all that out. But the J-League in general, they aren't going to punish clubs unless it causes games to be postponed and canceled and they can't be replayed, in which case then the clubs will be punished with losses. They'll lose points. And I don't think that we're going to see fines or anything like that unless there's something really egregious happening. And I think that all the clubs are going to be at least careful enough to avoid that.
Hmm. Have they found any root causes for any of these incidents, maybe at Gamba or Gifu, Kashima? We've had quite a few this season.
So the investigators found at Gamba that the main cause, that their cluster took place within the locker room, and that it was just an issue of the players not putting on masks after the game, and they were just talking for too long in close quarters. So that's what they believe to be the source of the Gamba cluster. And we don't know what happened at Gifu, so that's a bit of a mystery. And I think that not that the league isn't concerned with rooting these out, but I think they're just more concerned with damage control and prevention. They're not trying to get an inquisition going.
I believe there was a meeting again this week between the J-League and the MPB, just to kind of about emergency measures that are being put in and attendances with that. Am I right in thinking that they're still planning on attendances no matter what the COVID situation is?
Basically, that happened today, Monday, the 19th. That's right, the 19th. As listeners may or may not know, right now Japan is in a not quite state of emergency. which has been sort of nicknamed Mambo, which is shorthand for a very long Japanese phrase that I'm not even going to bother to attempt without notes. And we are looking at the possibility of another state of emergency being issued for Osaka and Tokyo. But both leagues came out and said that essentially, unless they're told by the government to close their doors, they're going to keep letting fans in as safely as possible. And that will mean probably attendance caps of 5,000 in the affected prefectures. But at this point, the J-League has held well over 1,000 games with fans since the pandemic started. NPB has done the same. They're both convinced that they have the knowledge, the experience, the tools, the data that shows that they can welcome fans to stadiums safely. And so that's where they're at. It's not a stance that I necessarily disagree with. It may not be the best optics. I think people are starting to get nervous at the rising cases across the country, but they feel like they can do it as long as fans follow the guidelines and mask up and keep their distance, then there is in theory no reason why they shouldn't be able to go to games safely.
Is there evidence, therefore, that they have conducted that shows that there's been no real link necessarily between fans going into the grounds and maybe a cluster forming because of that?
The leagues have been pretty diligent about keeping track of the fans, and of course fans are, it's all voluntary reporting, so contact tracing in Japan isn't necessarily as thorough as it is in some other countries, but neither league has found any clusters emerging from stadiums. There have been no fan-to-fan transmissions at the stadiums. There have been about 10 or 11 cases in which someone who was infected went to the stadium and then later found out that they were infected. But, that was 10 last season out of 8+ million fans who attended NPB and all the J-League competitions in the Climax series. So 10 out of 8 million, I mean, that's a pretty good statistic. You're basically, if you're going to a J1 game, there's a 1 in a million chance that you might have COVID. Obviously, this is relying on fans to be responsible and to not go to games if they're sick. But so far, it does appear to be working. And I think that if you were to have clusters emerging from a J-League game, it's fair to say that we would have heard something by now. Obviously, that isn't 100% proof. But the evidence does seem to indicate that it's working.
Just a kind of final one on that. Is there any indication that you've had that we might be seeing return to full stadiums at any time, perhaps not this season, maybe at the start of next season? Or do you kind of think this season is going to be, will be either at 5,000 or 50% and flitting in between, depending on the regional emergency measures?
The J-League had been hopeful to be able to get fans in sort of proportionally, depending on stadium size, up to 60, 70, 80%. They've been preparing their data. They've been looking to prove that they can do so. I don't know if that's going to happen this year, given the state of things. I mean, if we're going into a state of emergency, then that means restricted attendance into June, possibly into July. The vaccine rollout is obviously very slow in Japan at the moment for a number of reasons that I won't get into lest this become a two-hour episode. So getting above 50% in 2021 might be a very tough ask.
All right, absolutely terrific, Dan. Thanks for all those. And I guess, well, somewhat topically, considering the news that's come out of Europe today with the Super League idea, there were whispers a little while back about the creation of a Japanese Premier League. So can you put any concerned J-League supporters' fears to bed on the merits of that story, Dan?
So this is a very Japanese story that turned into a game of telephone. And the short answer is you don't have to worry. We're not getting a Premier League. We're not getting a Super League. Everything is cool. So what happened was that the league had its original 2030 vision just sort of in terms of its midterm business plans and what it had intended to do. Then the pandemic happened. Now they're going to come up with a new plan that they're going to start implementing from next year. So this is all, I mean, they describe it as 2B and 2C, as in two, you know, business to business, business to customer, things that they are looking to do to improve the standing of the league and improve everything, basically. And the story that got out was essentially that they are considering whether or not they will consider a Premier League.
Right.
So it's basically, you know, are we going to set up a, you know, they're having a committee to discuss what they're going to discuss in another committee. And these things, we're talking about things like supporting construction of a football stadium in central Tokyo, just ways of matching clubs and sponsors and just to do that more efficiently. Internally reorganizing the league to make, you know, to improve its value and to make it more competitive or more profitable or all these things. So these are all things that they want to consider. Now, as for things that they need to think about more, releasing restrictions on naming rights, allowing clubs to list themselves on the stock market, loosening the rules for hometown registrations, and reorganizing the league, which would create a Premier League. And then there's the things that they can't discuss for a number of reasons, such as the league supporting the import of superstar players, allowing foreign clubs to enter the league, and allowing sports betting. So these are things that they can't do for a number of reasons, and so they're not even considering it at this point. So there's this list, and I guess it got out, and they briefed us all at a press conference. And so none of this is a secret, but basically we don't have to worry about this for a long time.
Rightio then. Okay, and so, yeah, one more before we touch on the Wii League and then get on to stuff on the pitch in J1 over the weekend. There are some supporters from clubs in the ACL, specifically two groups, who still don't know where their group stage games are going to be played. Is there any developments on where those two groups might be hosted?
Not yet, as far as I know. It's still a bit of a mystery. The West Zone started play last week, and the East Zone is still, you know, there's a lot to be determined. And it's getting a bit close to things, but one assumes that they have to figure it out sooner or later.
Yeah.
Do you know why Japan didn't put themselves forward to host these groups when they did host a World Cup qualifier and a friendly against Korea?
I'm not sure, to be honest. They might not have been able to get government backing for it. Mm-hmm. I don't quite understand why they wouldn't have done that, and yet they will be hosting the centralized Group F, is it, that we're in for World Cup qualifying? So I guess Japan will be hosting six games in June. I wouldn't speculate as to why the JFA didn't throw its hat into that ring, but it could just be that the government wants to reduce the risk of something happening that would tarnish Japan's standing ahead of the Olympics. Maybe they were happy with how the JFA handled the national teams, and they just don't want it to get to be too much. Who knows at this point?
Okay, then. And so our last stop on our whistle-stop tour of Japanese football topics is the new Women's League, the Wii League. They're a ways from starting their season, Dan, but the preseason is about to kick off. And, you're right behind it.
Yeah, so They've been a little slow with the info, but the preseason is starting this Saturday, April 24th. A number of games are going to be shown streamed live. I believe the Japan office of 11 Sports is going to be showing a handful of these preseason games, and they've confirmed that they will be available internationally and with no registration required, so those links will be out and about. This weekend will be Kobe against Nagano, Urawa against Mainavi Sendai, Niigata against Sagamihara, and then I think it'll continue, basically. There will be 22 games played through mid-June, all ahead of the season opener in mid-September. So, you know, watch it if you can. The league needs all the help it can get. You know, this is a very ambitious project, and they're a long way from really getting over the hump. But if you look at how women's football is doing overseas, you know, there's a lot of potential for it to do well in Japan, and hopefully they manage to do so.
All right, fantastic. So we also have the not-so-small matter of Kashima sacking their manager since we recorded our last episode, but we'll get on to that when we touch on Antlers' trip to Tokushima on Saturday later on in the episode. So it was a wild and woolly weekend weather-wise in Japan. Saturday was very rough and very wet, but much clearer on Sunday, and if you looked up into the skies above Nagoya, you might just have seen pigs flying as Grampus finally conceded not just one, but two goals. Their first goals they'd conceded since the opening day when their own defender, Yutaka Yoshida, scored into his own net. That had been the only goal they'd conceded all season until Daichi Hayashi opened the scoring for visiting Sagan Tosu in just the 6th minute at the Toyota Stadium. Grampus already halfway towards matching last season's clean sheet record, more than halfway, in fact, with 9 already through their season so far. 9 straight clean sheets. They'd kept 7 straight at home, dating back to last November of last year. But, just 6 minutes in, Hayashi's glancing header from a Noriyoshi Sakai cross went out of the reach of Mitch Langerak and inside his left-hand post. Of course, this is a Tosu side, Sam, who could not score in midweek at home against the Gumba Osaka. So, yeah, as I said off the top, if you think you know what's coming in the J-League, you really... and if you ever want to bet on the J-League, my advice would just be to set your money on fire, because at least you'll get warm fingers for 10 seconds or so. But, what can you say? Tosu stunning us all. Obviously, ultimately running at 2-1 winners, which we'll get to. But, to break through after just 6 minutes must have stunned the Toyota Stadium crowd.
Yeah, it stunned the crowd. It stunned the players, I think. And it just kind of completely caught them out. And it's such a well-worked goal as well. A player down the line, Sakai, he has no real right to dig out the cross that he does from his position right on the byline. But he does so. Hayashi gets a little yard of space. It's not too much away from Mariana. And then he heads it absolutely perfectly off the post. No chance for Langerak. And it did stun Nagoya. And then for the rest of that first half, they were ragged, which is not a word I don't think I've used about Nagoya this season or for a long time, actually. But they were. And Tosu were right up at them. They were so confident after that first goal. And I thought, that first half especially, I thought Tosu were really good. And they preyed on Nagoya, who didn't react well to going behind.
So we knew that Tosu had obviously made a great start, but they'd kind of come back to the pack in recent weeks, hadn't they, Sam? And in midweek, as I said, they not only conceded a goal to Gumba Osaka for the first time this season, but were unable to score themselves. So what did they do differently on Sunday than in midweek or in some of their more flatter performances in recent weeks?
Well, what they've kind of done, they've lost to Cerezo, they've lost to Kawasaki, and then lost to Gamba. And in all three of those games, they were a little bit too reserved for my liking. They kind of gave the teams a bit more respect. And in this game, they kind of flipped that out and were just on the front foot from the start. And just went out to cause Nagoya problems, not to kind of sit in and just hope for a 0-0. It was a bit more of a positive mentality and kind of more befitting of where they are in the table rather than a normal Sagan Tosu side that would take a 0-0 draw against Nagoya. So it was really positive to see that. Yeah, and as you saw, just going straight at them from the off, they kind of just went into their shell a little bit more second half, but against this Nagoya side, you probably can do that at 2-0 up. So yeah, I thought really positive mindset from Tosu, and they got their rewards from it.
Yeah, Dan, so Tosu being one of the surprise packets early doors, we've mentioned them every week. We mention every club every week on the podcast. But, yeah, we'd been very surprised at their start to the season. And to go in 2-0 up, as they did when Sakai himself scored the second goal right on half-time, really sent Grampus in on their heels. And Tosu, a perfect example of what they're capable of, as Sam says, when they go at an opponent. They showed no fear. Grampus's stunning defensive record was a challenge that they look forward to breaking down, and they did twice in the first half.
It was just a very impressive performance by Tosu. I got to feel bad for Mitch Langerak to have his clean sheet streak end. Nine games he got it to. I mean, he's just been playing amazingly, and the Nagoya defense has just been incredible this season. But, you know, all good things have to come to an end at some point. And it's not surprising. We've seen that Tosu, we have this impression of them being a very defensive, very conservative team, but we've seen this season, like, they are capable of lighting opponents up if they have the opportunity. And it's fun to see them do their thing, certainly unexpected, and it's killing my J predictions for this season. But, you know, it's great content. It's great to watch, and certainly as a neutral, you can't complain.
Yeah, absolutely. They've been a terrific surprise through the first quarter or so of the season. So what about Grampus's reaction after the break then, Sam? As I said, they were stung by a second goal, and goodness knows how long it is since they've conceded twice in a J1 game. But Sakai's goal right before the break. Langerak, you're looking back, he will have liked to have done better on it. Got a strong hand to Sakai's shot, but really could only palm it into the goal. So they did get another Shou Inagaki special with 5 minutes left to set up what they hoped would be a grandstand finish. But it seemed from the highlights anyway that they huffed and puffed. But for the majority of the second half, they weren't really able to make significant inroads into the Tosu defence.
Yeah, there was no real grandstand finish. They had a lot of the ball second half, and they got their goal back, but it's a volley from Inagaki, which, I mean, they've been trying to rely on Inagaki scoring from goals from the edge of the area all season. There's not only so long you can rely on that. And really, like, they brought Kakitani on at half-time, they brought Soma on quite early into the second half, but none of them did anything, really. They didn't look like they were going to break Tosu down. And Tosu, they're the second-best defence in the league, and they kind of showed that in the second half. They kept Nagoya at arm's length. And Nagoya, they're just far too reliant, I think, on Mateus to kind of do something special. And the rest of them, yeah, it's just none of them really want to get the ball down and take it on and make something for themselves. Yamasaki and Kakitani don't look like scoring. Soma, I think, as you've mentioned before, is a bit inconsistent. Sometimes he can be fantastic, but didn't really offer anything here. And Mateus was kind of shut down pretty well. So, yeah, Tosu defended very well when they had to. But Nagoya, again, suffering from that lack of real dynamism going forward.
All right, and once again, we got a few questions from our patrons for this week's episode. Graham Freche is back for more. Graham Freche, I should have mentioned his Twitter handle in recent episodes. It's @J_League_Ultra. He's submitted questions on a couple of different teams, including one of the ones he supports, Nagoya Grampus. Now, I don't know, we might have to talk him off the ledge a little bit here, guys, but I mean, after one ordinary defensive performance this season. He looks like he might be ready to push the panic button, but I think we can talk him away from that. But on Grampus, Graham Freche asks, after displaying unknown defensive woes and conceding, these are his words, a ton of goals against Tosu, a ton of goals equals two, or fair enough, Graham Freche, was this the beginning of the end? Or a one-time mistake, since it pretty much displayed once again that Ficodenti teams can't cope with being behind. So, I don't know, Dan, I can understand Graham Freche's frustration here, perhaps. Obviously, he was enjoying the good times rolling with the defensive record, but a couple of goals against the Tosu side, who were very impressive on the day, I think, a one-time mistake. We can let Mitch Langerakini's defence off with this, surely, can't we?
I mean, this is a take so hot that I could heat up my tea with it. It's calm down. Let's all calm down. This isn't the end of the world. Tosu have proven time and time again, as I sort of alluded to earlier, when Tosu want, they can be a good team. Not just a winning team, but a good team. And we've really seen that this season. So, you know, I don't think there's any shame for Nagoya in this loss. I think that these sorts of losses, you know, this is every team under Ficodenti has experienced a loss or two like this. But I don't think that there's anything to worry about. I think that they'll bounce back.
Yeah, I mean, Sam, I'm sure you'll echo Dan's thoughts there.
Yeah, absolutely. Defensively, I wouldn't be too worried about Nagoya. I'm sure they'll be fine in the next few weeks. The only thing I would have share a concern with is the lack of reaction to going behind. And there have been games where Nagoya have been the team that had to force the issue, but have had to settle for 0-0 draws because of a lack of imagination going forward. And I think, as I've said before, the lack of clear-cut striker in this team is going to hurt them in plenty of games, but I mean, Nagoya are still going to win plenty more games than they're going to lose, so yeah, I wouldn't be too worried about one defeat to a team that played very well.
Yeah, certainly understand your frustration, Graham Fletcher, when your side concedes 200% more goals than they had all season in one game. But yes, it's still just three conceded from 11. And Mitch Langerak and the rest of the Grampus defence, I'm sure, will look to bounce back this Thursday, I believe it is, when they face Gumba in the first match of round 11. All right, well, we've led with the second place team this week. I thought Grampus conceding goals, not only one but two, was it worthy of being the game with top billing on this episode. I guess doubly frustrating for Grampus supporters, though, and Graham Freche will be sharing this thought as well, I'm sure, is that the leaders Kawasaki dropped points for the first time. So, there might have been pigs flying above Todoroki as well on Sunday when Frontale hosted Hiroshima, Sam. But ultimately, it ended 1-1. And, obviously plenty of talking points throughout this game. But Hiroshima might feel a little bit hard done to that they didn't come away with all 3 points at the end of the day.
I mean, they had the chances in the second half. They had Jung back in goal, made a couple of saves, and Santos probably had his best game. I still think there were issues to iron out with him, but there were occasions where he bullied Jessiel, where he got the ball, ran most of the half of the pitch, but didn't necessarily have the amount of support that he would need. But there were positive signs for Hiroshima. They got away with a lot in the first half because it was a procession of Kawasaki possession, but they didn't really click into a higher gear than second, I wouldn't have thought. And they just kind of had possession for possession's sake without creating too much, and that ultimately cost them in the end because that failure to kind of finish the game off against Hiroshima. They're a good team, Hiroshima. They've got good players. So when they're still in the game, as they did for this second half, they can create chances. And they might feel a little bit hard done to. I mean, but I think they'd probably take the 1-1 draw, especially given how the first half was going.
Yeah, fair enough, Dan. I don't know about you, but I was getting flashbacks to the Tamagawa Classico when Akihiro Iyanaga opened the scoring in typically clinical fashion 7 minutes before half time. It was just nonchalant, as we've come to expect from Iyanaga, and just a absolutely classy finish, wasn't it?
Yeah, just I saw that goal, and I thought that Kawasaki were going to run away with the game. I was a bit surprised that they settled for the draw. But then again, I think I feel like Kawasaki aren't really used to being in that position where they have to fight for the win. They take the lead, you know, once they've got like a 2-goal lead, generally they know that they're in control of the game and that they can't screw up to the point where they're going to lose. But, you know, when it's 1-1 and you know, you lose a goal to VAR and things are nervy, you know, it is a situation that they struggle with sometimes. So disappointing for them. I certainly would have expected them to get a win, but it is a very sort of frontale way of going about things.
Yes, so, well, they did take a 2-0 lead, didn't they, Sam? And there's, I don't know if, I'm not sure we're going to wheel out the jingle this early in the episode, but, there was a VAR review. Leandro Damião was definitely offside, but whether he was interfering with play, he certainly didn't touch the ball as Kyohei Noborizato crossed in from the left, and Kaoru Toma arrived at the back post, most definitely onside to fire home. How did you feel this decision went? Obviously, it did ultimately go in Hiroshima's favour and the goal was disallowed. Did you feel it was the correct decision?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was quite interesting when this was going. I didn't really know which way the VAR was going to side, but I think when the ball goes so close to Damião, I think if he was a shoe size bigger, he'd have made contact with it. So when it goes so close to him, he has to be classed as interfering with play, especially in the 6-yard box. So, yeah, I think maybe Kawasaki fans might think it's a little harsh, but, yeah, I thought the right decision was made.
All right, so that came 10 minutes into the second half, and then 10 minutes after that, one of the incidents that, Sam's mentioned with the junior Santos led to Hiroshima equalising. The goalkeeper, Keisuke Osako, played a long ball forward to Junior Santos out on the left-hand touchline. He got past Jeziel and dribbled into and then across the box. His shot came back off Jun Sung Ryong's right-hand post, but Tsukasa Morishima was first to the loose ball, and from a tight angle, his shot went in off Ao Tanaka. And then, from there, Dan, it was, pretty much a 50-50 game. Obviously, Hiroshima will be happy to have left with a point from Todoroki. Not many teams get to say that, of course. But very, very late on, the Kawasaki keeper Jung had to tip a cross come shot from Shunki Higashi wide. So it could have been even better for Hiroshima, couldn't it? At the death.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of Hiroshima. Still, I remember that they were sort of a favorite among a bunch of people, I think possibly including myself, to really surprise and make their way up in the standings. But of course, now we're a quarter of the way into the season, and here they are in seventh place, still with plenty of room to go up. But I feel like they should be doing better than 15 points behind the leaders, which is where they're at now. So, I don't know if this is Jofuku being Jofuku, or if they've just been unlucky. I mean, certainly only 2 losses so far. That's not bad at all. But if you look at 5 draws, you turn this result into a win. Suddenly they're at 19. You know, a couple more of those go their way, and they're in the ACL zone. So, you know, maybe a bit unlucky, but I really want to see more from them going forward.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, so they are the results for the top 2 wrapped up then. Indeed, the top 3 as a Sagan Tosu moved back to 3rd in the table, back above Kobe, who drew 0-0 at Shonan Bellmare on Saturday. Probably a game we can skip over quite quickly, Sam. Probably most notable for the first appearance of Ayub Masika, Kobe's new attacker, who one of the new players actually allowed onto the pitch and able to take part in J-League action for the first time after quarantining up in the J-League bubble. And, Masika was just about the best thing about this game, which says a lot about the first 66 minutes of it, Sam. But, Masika looked very Bright, a couple of chances, shot into the side netting, and looked to create for his teammates. So quite a bright and impressive debut.
Yeah, I thought he looked pretty sharp. I kind of grown to like him immediately. He did an interview with the JLE English channel, and yeah, he came across as such a nice guy, and he was saying just how he's going to bring so much pace to this team, he's going to bring energy, and he kind of did. Yeah, he had a couple of chances, one into the side netting, just sparked some life into this game, which was so dull. I mean, Kobe performed very poorly in general. I thought Shonan out of both teams were the better side. They had the occasional header, which kind of went wide, but there was no real clear-cut chances, I don't think, until Sakai right at the end for Kobe. But yeah, it was good to see Masika out there. He looks like he could bring a decent amount to this team. Maybe if you play him off one wing, Furuhashi off the other, and then the other new signing, Lincoln, when he's available, maybe he comes in. Then you've got a really dynamic front three if that comes to pass. But yeah, he looked pretty good, but the rest of the game, I think, yeah, we can skip over because it was just pretty much a non-event.
No worries. Yeah, fair enough then. All right, so, but I did say in last week's episode this was arguably the most intriguing of the five games that were played on Saturday, so that shows how much I know. But anyway, another let's call it another creditable point for Shonan, as they continue to nudge up towards mid table. I'm not sure if 13th out of 20 quite qualifies as mid table, but they're probably telling themselves that it does. Also moving above Kobe over the weekend was Cerezo Osaka. They also played on Sunday after taking part in midweek J1 action, which of course Sam wrapped up at last Wednesday for our patrons, a Patreon exclusive J1 match day wrap up there from Sam, which was great once again, Sam. I should have mentioned that off the top. Thanks again for doing that. So Cerezo hosted Urawa, a game notable for the 500th appearance in J1 for Reds' veteran goalkeeper Shusaku Nishikawa. Unfortunately for him, it ended in defeat for his side. Yusuke Murahashi finally scoring the only goal of the game in the 66th minute after some pinball wizard from a corner. Then Murahashi's shot deflecting off a defender and squirming in despite a frantic attempt to clear off the line by Takuya Iwanami. But that had come after some, frankly, head-scratching VAR incidents. So, gents, I believe it's time to roll out the theme music. It's time for This Week in VAR. This Week in VAR. This Week. All right, well, before we get to the major VAR incident, sorry, listeners, we'll wrap up a couple of chances for Reds at the end of the first half and then early in the second half. Yoshio Koizumi drew a leaping save from Kim Jin-hyun with a 25-yard blast. And then, early in the second half, Koizumi played in Takahiro Akimoto, but he shot wide under pressure. So next, Sam, a couple of, really head-scratching incidents, as I said. Cerezo escaped a lengthy VAR scare after the ball did appear to hit Marohashi's arm as he was sliding through to try and prevent Yuki Muto getting a cross away. So, first things first, was the correct decision reached here?
It was an interesting one because you could have argued there might have been a foul as well when Murahashi goes to block because there's contact between feet with him and Muto. But I think Muto kicks him and then the ball does hit Murahashi on the arm. But I think it's just enough into the upper region of his arm that it doesn't count as handball. So I think I'm just about on the side of the referee there. I think no penalty was the right call.
Yes, kind of under your bicep, right? What's the correct way to describe it? Kind of where lower bicep, is that, would that be the correct technical term?
No idea, but let's go
with it. Hit him on the sleeve. Let's go with that, yeah. And then, well, Dan, this is wrong, I think, for so many reasons. But anyway, the referee, of course, the most decorated referee, I would say, in J-League history, Yuichi Nishimura, awarded a free kick rather than a penalty after Riku Matsuda's shot struck Reds' Koizumi on the arm just inside the box. Nishimura, yeah, thinking it was on the line or just outside, or on the line is in, so he must have thought it was outside. Then after a VAR review, with Cerezo expecting this review to net them a penalty, Nishimura instead changed his decision to a drop ball to Reds, despite the ball deflecting off Koizumi and out for a corner. So if it wasn't going to be changed to a penalty, or a free kick. Well, yeah, this is just wrong for so many reasons. And I don't know if you're going to do a better job than summing it up than I did, but hopefully you can.
Yeah, this was not good VAR. Nishimura obviously has a history of making some very bewildering calls in the course of his career. And this is certainly one of them. If I'm a Cerezo fan, yeah, you're happy for the win, but you can't do that. You know, just not the right call. It's pretty cut and dry. So, woof is all I have to say. Obviously, we've had somewhat of a better implementation of video review than in Europe. Somewhat, I say, but it's still not perfect. And the problem is that video review is only going to be as good as the people who are making the calls. And Nishimura has been inconsistent in how he's blown the whistle over the years. And unfortunately, this match was no different.
So, Sam, we've seen the handball law basically changed. It's been evolving throughout this calendar year, this last year and a bit. Since football restarted, with obviously it's been much more strict in previous months, and it seems to be softening now. Where previously, if the ball hit your arm, it was a penalty, and now there's much more judgment being applied to each incident, and I think referees and VARs and etc. are being instructed to be more lenient with ball to hand decisions. So ultimately, has Nishimura decided this wasn't a handball at all? I guess he must have done that, because he'd awarded a free kick. He either changes it to a penalty or he sticks with his original decision. So it's not a handball at the end of the day, according to Nishimura. Then
that seems to be what's gone on here. It's hard to get your head around, because yeah, he must have given handball and he thought it was outside the area. The VAR must have looked at it and thought, yeah, it is an offence, but it's in the area. You're going to have to come and have a look and change your mind. And he looks over, and then I can half understand it, because he's definitely trying to tuck his arm into his body. So if he looks at that and says, or whatever this silhouette is, oh, it's not outside the silhouette, I'm not going to give it, then I can half understand it. But yeah, they don't know really how they got to the decision. It was quite baffling how it went. And as for the end of it, with it going for a corner, I think that they have to call play dead after a decision by VAR. So I think they have to start with a drop ball. As unfair as it seems to Cerezo, we've gone from having a penalty to not even getting a corner. But yeah, awfully managed. But I can see why the decision has been made.
You know, what they have to do is they have to borrow the microphones that cricket uses. Because don't they have that thing where, like, they can, like, tell, you know, they can tell from the waveform from if the ball has hit the pads or if it hit the bat. You know, is that what we're going to need? Where, you know, we have to come up with, you know, a way to audibly tell if the ball made contact with the uniform or with the arm. I don't know. I hope we don't get to the way that things are in the Premier League, but, you know, I feel like this was a call that didn't need to be made.
Yeah, really, really puzzling. And well, yeah, maybe the VAR originally asked Nishimura over to tell him that he didn't think it was a handball in the first place. So we obviously don't know that. But yeah, what transpired was very confusing. And you could see that if Nishimura's followed the rules to the letter of the law, then plenty of the Cerezo players and management team and support staff don't know what the rule is, because they were absolutely stunned at the fact that, yeah, they weren't being awarded a corner if it wasn't indeed a handball on the final decision. So, we can't really shed any light on how that decision was reached, but that was This Week in VAR. This Week in VAR. This Week. So shortly after falling behind, Reds striker Shinzo Kuroki headed Yuki Muto's lofted cross just wide as the Reds looked to hit back. Then Takahiro Sekine headed Daigo Nishi's cross over. But then in the last 5 minutes or so, Cerezo really should have been wrapping up the points. Motohiko Nakajima headed wide after a lightning Cerezo counter-attack. Then Mutsuki Kato shot straight at Nishikawa deep into stoppage time. So, yeah, for Nishikawa, a decorated career, one that is still, a ways to run, you would say. But, yeah, to reach 500 J1 appearances is a huge feather in his cap. And, the Reds custodian for so many years now, unfortunately for his side, wasn't able yet to mark the occasion with a win. But, unfortunate. But Cerezo, very happy. VAR controversy aside, as Dan said, to win the game, thanks to their captain on the day, Yusuke Marohashi. All right, well, Cerezo back up to fourth, as we mentioned. Up to sixth now are Yokohama F. Marinos. We're going to cast our minds back, gents, all the way back to last Friday night. And, Nishikawa's occasion was spoiled down in Osaka. Sapporo, the hosts on Friday night, were celebrating their 25th anniversary on this evening. And, with 10 minutes to go, Dan, it looked like they were going to be celebrating in some style after Anderson Lopez's goal 2 minutes into the second half. But then they did not count on the Yokohama F. Marinos flipping this game on its head in the last 10 minutes.
They most certainly did not, even though if you're a Sapporo fan, you're probably expecting something like this to happen. But an inspired comeback from Marinos, a couple of great, really three great goals in a 20-minute period. You had Onaiwu, Maeda, and then Elber, who not only scored, but really scored twice after his goal was called off. I believe it was another VAR incident, if memory serves. But just a fantastic performance, and you could see how happy our favorite manager, Ange, was after the game, and that speaks volumes, because to get him to smile is no small feat.
Yes, indeed. So this had this game had plenty of a goalmouth incidents, Sam. As early as the eighth minute, the Sapporo keeper Takanori Sugano was called into action to make a fine save, tipping Marcos Junior's point-blank header onto the bar. And, chances came at both ends. I mean, Anderson Lopez will be ruining Chanatip's slightly overhit layoff for 2 minutes before the break, because, if he had have converted there, and then obviously, I know Butterfly flapping its wings, etc., but also scoring 2 minutes into the second half. I mean, Sapporo might have been out of sight, but you have to give credit to F. Marinos. They stick to their methods, they stick to their process, and as Dan said, it paid off with the three terrific goals.
Yeah, they deserve to win quite clearly, I thought, in this game. They had so many chances. Sugano had the game of his life in goal. His face tipping Marcos Junior's header onto the bar. He saved from Onaiwu. There were just countless saves in this game, and he was the only reason that this was 1-0 as it was after Anderson Lopez got his standard kind of fortunate goal that deflects in off various people. But, I thought fully deserved, and it just kept coming. It did look like it might be one of those days for Marinos where they just keep going and keep going, but it wouldn't fall for them. But in the end, that kind of glut of goals towards the end, it was fully deserved. Very good 3 points for them.
Yeah, so I guess ultimately, obviously Anderson Lopez missing that chance before the break, but with 20 minutes left, the save that Yohei Takaoka made from Akito Fukumori, that might have proved crucial at the end of the day, because that obviously kept F. Marinos just a goal behind, the young goalkeeper doing well. And then, what can you say about Jun Amano's stunning piece of skill out on the right to turn his man inside out before crossing with the outside of his left boot for Onaiwu to touch home. in the 80th minute. Kota Mizunuma's cross was met with a diving header that I'm sure Sam enjoyed just 2 minutes later. And then, yeah, as Dan says, Elba scored a good goal in the 96th minute, but that was disallowed after the ball had hit Tiraton's arm in the build-up. But, yeah, Elba wrapped up the points in the ninth minute of stoppage time when he fired home high into the net. That had come, both of those goals, in inverted commas, for Elba had come after Jay Bothroyd headed inches over for Sapporo, their best last chance of the game just before stoppage time. So that is now 8 unbeaten for F Marinos, and as I say, they're up to 6th. We had a question on them, another one from Graham Freche on F Marinos, and it was, as he says, undefeated since an opening day loss, which was against the champions. Marinos are pretty much flying under the radar at the moment. Will they become this year's J-Pred Kashima, and therefore probably the biggest opposition for Frontale? Again, that's a bit defeatist, Graham Freche, because your side, Grampus, are still 8 points clear of F. Marinos, saying that having played 2 games more. But what do you reckon, Sam, from what you've seen of F. Marinos and what they're capable of, once the dust settles, are they likely to be at least top three contenders, if not knocking down Grampus's door?
I think they've always been considered top three contenders. They've got so much quality in the side. It's just whether they can be consistent enough to have a focused push to really push Kawasaki all the way, and I don't think they can. I mean, yes, they beat Sapporo here, but Sapporo are a very nice team to go and play against. They'll give you chances. But, I mean, last weekend they drew with Vegalta Sendai 0-0, so it's not like they're going on this massive run, sweeping everyone before them and look like they're genuine title contenders. I think they're one of a bunch of teams that will be challenging for the ACL, and I think they would expect to be in those positions. But, yeah, there are too many occasions still this season, even though they're not necessarily losing, but Sendai a draw, Shonan a draw. They performed very poorly in that 3-3 draw with Sanfrecce Hiroshima. So, yeah, I think there are still consistency issues that need to be ironed out with Marinos before they can really be considered on the same level as Kawasaki.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, so we're moving our way down the table here, and I think we're probably down into mid-table as we get to FC Tokyo in 8th spot, Dan. A very frustrating watch for us on Saturday as the side that we both support headed down to Fukuoka. And, well, I mentioned the ever-evolving handball law. I don't know if you want to have a bit of a complaint about the incident about 6 or 7 minutes into the second half where Tokyo might have had a penalty for a handball against a Fukuoka defender. But ultimately, this game has come down to the homekeeper, Masaaki Murakami, making a couple of superb saves to deny Diego Oliveira in the first half. And, Tokyo being caught out by one of their old boys, Sultan Tanabe, who set up Bruno Mendes for the winner for Avispa as they triumphed 1-0 on the afternoon. It was just one of those from FC Tokyo, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, that's basically what I was about to say. Just one of those. That it was a very Tokyo loss. That they just didn't have what they need. They just the defense still looks shaky. Hopefully, with Bruno Vini in training now, we'll see him before too long, and that will help them a lot. I think that they just need some support at the back for the Brazilians, for the Brazilian attackers to really start pushing forward and focusing more on their jobs. And we saw that. I think Avispa are just the kind of team who can grind Tokyo down, and they've beaten Tokyo on numerous occasions before. So they're almost sort of bogey team at this point, and just it is what it is. I think this game showed what Tokyo are capable of right now, and whether Uvini can change that or not is to be determined.
Yeah, so Sam, well, Dan and I are feeling quite sorry for ourselves. So I'd like you, if you could, to talk up a Fukuoka here, because I would be doing so through gritted teeth because, I do feel a little bit hard done to because a few months ago, I think that probably would have been a penalty for handball. And whether that's harsh or not, we were used to people complaining that the decisions were too harsh. But then, to see the law seemingly changed on a month-to-month basis or at an in-season basis is very frustrating. And I'm not suggesting that Tokyo deserved to win the game. Murakami's saves were absolutely terrific. And, Diego Oliveira was left frustrated. But, why don't you big up Fukuoka? Because this is obviously a huge win for them. Their third of the season. And, ultimately, as a Tokyo supporter, I don't think Dan and I can say that they didn't deserve it on the afternoon.
No, I thought they were the better team, especially second half. They kind of went from strength to strength, and so you were at times fortunate not to concede further. There was that moment, maybe 15 minutes from time, where Yamagishi had a shot flicked onto the bar by Ogawa, Salomonson followed up, and then Watanabe cleared off the line. So, there were at times it was quite desperate defending from Tokyo, and Abysma rode their luck first half, and you can argue they rode their luck with this handball. I mean, it's an interesting one. I probably agree with you that it would have been given last season, but I have to check the rules, whatever their rules are for this week. And there's a line in there that says if there's a deflection from a player, opposition or your own team, but in close proximity, then it goes on to hit your hand, then it can't be given as handball. So I guess he's probably about 2 meters away from the player it deflects off. So I guess they're saying it's probably close enough that deflection counts, so it's not handball. So yeah, maybe they got away with one. I'd have been annoyed if I was an Avispa fan and conceded a penalty in that manner. But then I can see why Tokyo fans would be unhappy, given the decision, I think, to meter last year, where, it was pretty unfortunate for Tokyo in that one. So, I can see the frustration. But, I think Avispa deserved to win the game. The second half, especially, they caused a lot of problems for Tokyo. Tokyo didn't really have an answer. And defensively, I think there are issues at Tokyo because you've moved Morishige into midfield to plug that gap because Aoki has not been able to fill and various others you've tried in that position. But then that just leaves holes at the back where you're without your main right back, who wasn't really a main right back because you never replaced Maroya. And then the two centre-backs, it's not really working between Watanabe and Umari or Okazaki if he plays there. So maybe Uvini, you need him to come in and maybe solidify a little bit because, they're a little bit all over the place second half.
Yes. Now, Dan, since we've got you on, Thomas Pennington will probably want me to ask you if you know anything about the story behind Leandro being absent for so many league games recently. There were rumours flying around that he'd lost a close personal friend and his motivation, if that's the right word, was seriously impacted. He was hit hard by the loss of a friend, but then there was also rumours flying around that it was a disciplinary issue related to not starting a particular game and then not apologising after kicking off. It could be a combination of the two, and there might be other things thrown in amongst it. And I'm not sure how close your finger is to the pulse behind the scenes at FC Tokyo. You might not be able to shed any more light on us, but I feel obliged to ask anyway if you know any more about it.
I don't. To be honest, I don't know what's up with the situation. Obviously, Leandro is a very what's the word we're looking for here? Temperamental. Sometimes he is sometimes a very temperamental player and a very emotional player for better sometimes and for worse sometimes. If he hasn't been playing because of a personal issue, that's totally fine. That's up to him, and I hope that he's getting whatever support he needs. And if it's because of discipline, then hopefully Hasegawa knows what he's doing. Certainly he was feeling good enough to tangle with Neil in the comment on Twitter the other day. So, I would think that after some of his previous Twitter infractions, he would know better than to get into a fight that he shouldn't be getting into. Certainly, that's a lesson that all of us could stand to remember sometimes. But yeah, I don't think it's anything major. But certainly, the more he plays, the better Tokyo will be.
Leandro versus Neil Debnam is the Twitter spat we all wanted to see in 2021.
That was less than a week ago. That is how blessed we have been with just hashtag content this week. It all kicked off when Leandro, you know, went Twitter fingers on Neil, and then all of a sudden we have a Super League. Mourinho's been fired.
All dominoes, Dan. Yeah, Neil Debnam was the first one to fall. Yeah, I can imagine Neil's heart skipping a beat when he saw that, when he first laid eyes on that tweet from Leandro. That was, absolutely incredible. Incredible times in Chaos Energy J-League. That's the perfect summation of it, I think, in tweet form. But it's good to know that Leandro's right across the socials. He might even be listening in now. If you are, Leandro, obrigado for listening, mate. Absolutely love your work. And, hope you're back to your absolute best in the starting 11 for FC Tokyo very, very soon. Unfortunately, it was not a Tokyo's day on Saturday, although for Avispa supporters, kudos to your side. A deserved win, as we've said, and no sour grapes at all from Dan and myself. The other promoted team, Tokushima Vortis, they didn't have the best of Saturdays, but they were finally able to welcome their new Spanish coach, Dani Poyatos, to the touchline at the Pocari Sweat Stadium. I don't know, they've been doing pretty well without Poyatos on the sideline, so maybe they should have asked him to stay away for another week. But there was also a slightly unfamiliar, an unexpected face on the opposing touchline, Sam, after Naoki Soma came in, he was already an assistant, wasn't he? But he was appointed to replace the previous manager, Zago, who was let go after our last recording. We do have a couple of questions on the timing of this from Kashima. They were in a similar position in the league last year and obviously ended up finishing in the top six. Your thoughts overall on the firing of Zago and the appointment of Naoki Soma?
Yeah, I was a little surprised. As you said, it's almost identical to where Kashima were last season, and he showed last year that he can get the team out of that sort of situation and push them on towards the ACL. They're a fraction of a centimetre, I think, away from being in the ACL this season. So, yeah, it's slightly weird. I don't know exactly if anything's gone on behind the scenes. I know the team weren't playing very well, so you can sort of understand it, and there is now the threat of a relegation. I don't think Kashima are going to be relegated by any stretch of the imagination, but that threat is there rather than last season. They could allow things to play out however they were, and they knew that nothing could really go wrong for them. So maybe that's played into it, but yeah, it's a bit of a surprise. Soma will come in. He looked immediately to kind of make the team a bit more rigid at the back, a lot more defensive, which isn't great for a neutral, but I mean, it got them a win and a clean sheet in this game. So it'd be interesting to see how he does long term. But yeah, I thought it was a little bit surprising. I'd have thought he maybe earned the right to go on a little bit longer, given how he'd recovered things last season.
Well, yeah, Dan, of course, we mentioned Masika coming in for Kobe, and some of the new foreign players are finally, you know, available to train and indeed play with their clubs. And Antlers were bringing in a couple of seemingly important Brazilian additions to their squad, and neither of those have featured so far. Did you think it was a little bit harsh on Zago to pull the pin on him after... Antlers had only played 8 games up to the point where Zaga was let go, and indeed they'd taken 4 points from the last 2 games. So just let me set up questions from Johnny Nicol and Gabrielle Anello along a similar theme, basically. So Johnny asked, do you think Zaga has any reason to feel harshly treated by Antlers following his dismissal? And Gabrielle asks, was it the right move to give up on Zago's project this soon?
I think he's been a little hard done by. I understand where Antlers are coming from. I think among J-League clubs, I think that Antlers fans are second only behind Urawa fans in terms of how strongly they demand results and how focused they are on getting good results. And I think that it's a very demanding fan base. And I think that he had the benefit of the doubt last season after a very slow start, turned things around, finished fifth. He had the Chaos Energy J League boost going for him, but to have two slow starts in a row when you're already 21 points off the pace, even, well, I guess after this win, you know, they're still 21 points off the pace, even with two games in hand. That's not good. It's not good enough for the fans out there in Ibaraki, or I guess the fans out in Tokyo who make the trip to Ibaraki every weekend. So it's tough business. I don't think that they should have pulled the trigger this soon, but they have. And I guess if you want to call Naoki Soma a new manager bump, that's what they have, and that's the hill they're going to die on this season, for better or for worse.
Yeah, so we had the an unexpected managerial matchup that, obviously that when we recorded last week's episode, we weren't expecting to see Poyatos and especially Soma on the touchline. I guess somewhat fittingly for Antlers, Soma, of course, a former Japan national team defender and indeed four-time J1 champion in his extended period with Antlers. It was an Antlers defender, Koki Machida, who headed in the only goal of the game in the 31st minute. He met Katsuya Nagato's corner with a perfectly timed run and headed in past Naoto Kami Fukumoto. Kami Fukumoto did save well either side of half-time from ISA Wada. And then Yudai Konishi fired Tokushima's best chance of the second half over from inside the D midway through or late in the second half. But, it wasn't Tokushima's day. And Poyatos, he'll be relishing, I think, getting his players onto the training pitch and actually be able to be there and, talk them through how they're going to bounce back from this result in their next league game. But, for Soma, a winning start to his career as Antlers manager after two previous stints with Machida Zelvia and indeed a season and a bit with Kawasaki Frontale in the Todoroki dugout. All right, thanks to Johnny and Gabrielle for your questions on Zago. For me, I do think it's a little bit harsh, as I say, especially when he wasn't allowed the opportunity to work with his two new Brazilian signings. But, yes, it's a cruel game. Indeed, and no worries about that. All right, so three games to go. Another goalless draw to cover. On Sunday, the fourth of the four games on Sunday, saw Gamba Osaka host Shimizu. That ended goalless. Of course, Gamba were coming off a high, winning for the first time this season away at Tosu on Wednesday, and indeed scoring a goal for the first time all year when Takashi Osami put paid to Sagan in midweek. Early doors, Osami looked to double his fun. In the fourth minute, he shot across the face of goal. Up the other end, Thiago Santana fired wide, also inside the first 10 minutes. Then Gamba hit the woodwork twice before half-time. Takashi Osami himself shot from the edge of the box, but it came back off the bar in the 20th minute, and then 4 minutes before the break, Yosuke Itaguchi's first-time shot, it would have been an absolute worldie from 30 yards, crashed into the post. Thiago Santana blasted high and wide shortly before half-time. And then, the second half kind of just happened, didn't it? It was, really disappointing, I suppose, for Gamba that they weren't able to build on, their first victory of the season in midweek.
Yeah, I mean, neither team really came out for the second half. You could have just ended it at half-time and no one would have been bothered by it. Everyone wasted their time that for the second 45. I don't know if Gamba were just a bit tired after their exploits in midweek and the fixture pile up there at the beginning to get into, but yeah, and they didn't really create too much. I think there was a Yamamoto chance right at the end, which he dragged wide, but yeah, not a lot really of excitement for either team. Shimizu didn't offer anything going forward second half, and really in the first half they had the occasional moment where Santana got through and then just rushed his shot and shot from 25-30 yards. So yeah, a really poor game to watch. I mean, you'd hoped that Gamba might have got a bit of confidence after the win in midweek, but after seeing a couple of efforts off the woodwork, it kind of dropped again, and it was just another pretty dull affair, I'm afraid.
Well, yeah, I mean, Dan, this is another example of, never knowing what to expect in the J-League. I mean, if there was any club that you would, at the start of the season, if you said after six games they'd have one goal scored and two conceded, I know they have been a little bit tighter in recent years under Miyamoto, but, somebody who's followed the J-League for a number of years, the last team you would expect to have a record like that is Gunma Osaka, but here they are. They've obviously had that layoff. You would have thought they would have come back fresh and firing and pumped to start banging goals in for fun, but instead, yeah, they're just finding it really, really hard work at the moment, aren't they?
They are. Yeah, they have been unfortunate victims of circumstance, I think is the best way to describe their situation. It is what it is. They have time, and I think they have the benefit of there being a few teams under them in the table who are legitimately worse. Actually, I'm not sure if there are teams under the table because I'm not looking at the table, but realistically, there should be several teams who are worse than Gamba Osaka. If I'm a Gamba fan, I'm not panicking yet. I think they've got plenty of time to work things out, but I think that the time to establish themselves as a contender for anything in the league, maybe it's starting. You know, maybe that clock is ticking. I don't think it's run out, but it's definitely started to tick.
Yeah, and so, well, I mean, technically, Sam, the best defense in the J-League after the floodgates opened at the Toyota Stadium, and Grampus let in two goals in a game, a shock horror. But so Gumba with two goals conceded from six games, and it's a really interesting question or point, isn't it, from Johnny Nickel that he sent through this afternoon. This year, Gumba are basically Nagoya minus Sho Inagaki's goals from distance. How much truth do you think is in that statement? And I mean, yeah, we've spoken about Grampus's struggles to break sides down, especially in the past month or so, and oftentimes they've been bailed out by worldies from Sho Inagaki. So that's an absolutely, I think it's a superb observation from Johnny, and I'm right behind it.
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels that you can draw between the two sides. I mean, in goal, you'd argue I've got the two best goalkeepers in the league. Both defences very solid. I'd probably nudge Nagoya just ahead. But, yeah, very similar. Jusei Zhong has come into midfield, and he's defensively very good. I mean, I wasn't 100% sure on his signing when he first came in. But, yeah, alongside Izuguchi, he does a lot of the dirty work very well. So that's another it's a good pairing. It's very similar to if you're having Izuguchi as your Sho Inagaki. I mean, he was close to getting an Inagaki-type goal in this game. And then, yeah, the strikers, there's just not a lot coming from them. You'd argue maybe on paper, the Gamba forward line, you'd expect a lot more from. Bringing in the players that they have, Thiago Alves should be doing more. Leandro Pereira's not made the last two squads, but then Lusami, you've got, you expect goals from him. Patrick, I think, is a little bit more suited to coming on as a substitute, and I don't think he lasts the 90 minutes too well, and so I'd be hoping that Leandro Pereira would kind of take that position and allow Patrick to be used as a super sub, as he was at times last season. But yeah, it's very similar to Nagoya. You're not expecting to see much out of him at the moment this season, but yeah, it's been Gamba, I think, attacking-wise, should be doing a lot better. There's so many players there that should be scoring goals, and you've got to think that eventually these players will click and they will start scoring some more goals, and nil-nils might be a thing of the past at the Panasonic Stadium.
Yes, and as I mentioned earlier, these two teams meet on Thursday night in the first game of Match Day 11, so that's going to be fascinating. It might end up being nil-nil, but I'm sure it'll be fascinating regardless. All right, so we've got two games left to review, listeners, and they both involve teams who began and indeed finished the match day in the bottom six. Oita hosted Kashiwa. Dan, Reysol ended up winning 1-0, and this game centred on two penalty decisions. The first one was awarded to the visitors, Reysol, early in the second half after Yuta Kamiya's shot hit the outstretched arm of Keisuke Saka. The home keeper, Shun Takagi, saved Kamiya's penalty, but Ataru Esaka was first to the loose ball, to slot home the rebound and give Reysol the lead. But then in the 90th minute, it looked like Oita were going to get out of jail, only for the visiting keeper Kim Sung-gyu to also save the penalty, and then a mighty kerfuffle that included a Yamato Machida getting kicked in the head, and arguably a second penalty should have been awarded. But, at the end of the day, Reysol have escaped with all 3 points here, a much-needed 3 points it is indeed for them.
Yeah, they got off very lucky, considering, you know, the club having to deal with this second. I don't think that the situation at Reysol has been designated as a cluster, but what is saved and the game, stoppage time, save and then off the post, doesn't get any better than that. That's just the game. I think that, you know, both the penalty calls were fair, which I don't think you can complain about. You know, the collision, I don't think that there's anything in that collision itself that needs to really be reviewed. I'll have to look at that kick again. But, a deserved result for Kashiwa. This is the kind of game you'd expect from both teams, and I think that that's just how it goes.
Yes, so Sam, the Reysol defender, Takumi Kamijima, who of course had spent last season on loan at Avispa, gave away the penalty when a corner was sent in from the left and, bounced across the box and flicked Kamijima's arm. And then after, as Dan says, Kim saved Kohiisa's penalty onto the post, Yamato Machida flung himself at the ball and Kamijima did the same, obviously looking to make amends for giving away the spot kick in the first place. It's, I don't know, it's one of those where there's, it could go either way, I suppose. But looking at it, it did look pretty harsh because Machida's diving in to try and head in the loose ball and Kamijima's going in with his foot. So it's, I guess, I don't know, how did you see it?
Yeah, it was a kind of a big smash, wasn't it, at the end? I mean, everyone diving in for everything. I can see why you would think that there should be another penalty given, and maybe Kamijima's got a little bit lucky, but I think he deserves a bit of luck this season because a lot of things have gone against him, be it the red card he got on the first day of the season, then he got a red card, or was it an own goal? Something went wrong, whatever it was, in the Levain Cup, and then this as well. So he's not had the run of the rub of the green so far this season, so maybe he deserved to get away with one. But yeah, I can definitely see some strong arguments for Oita getting a second penalty.
Yeah, so two straight wins now for Reysol, and they are up to the giddy heights of 15th in the table. I think it's six straight defeats now for Oita, isn't it? And they, they are really struggling. A long way to travel, of course. So finally to the battle of the bottom at Mitsuzawa on Saturday afternoon. Yokohama FC, the bottom side in J1, hosted 19th placed Sendai. Yokohama FC were 2-0 up, but Sendai earned a point with a fight back inside the last 10 minutes. So ever so briefly, I'll run you through the goals. The hosts, Yokohama FC, took a 17th minute lead when Tatsuki Seko swung in a corner from the right. The ball was flicked on at the near post before Yutaro Hakamata arrived in the centre to volley home in off Jakub Slovic. Keijiro Ogawa delivered a superb cross in from the left, and Kosuke Saito headed past Slovic to double Yokohama FC's advantage in the 68th minute. But then Sendai began their fight back when a corner was swung in from the left, and Takuma Nishimura powered home a header in the 82nd minute. Then after a VAR offside review, Kyohei Yoshino's 91st minute equaliser stood after Yuta Minami had saved a header, and then Yoshino tapped in from inches out. Vegelta could have won it with the last touch of the game, but former Japan international Yusuke Minagawa's header flew just wide. So, I suppose a just result between two pretty ordinary teams, but Yeah, you probably could have. That's one of the bets you probably could have made at the start of the J-League weekend that probably would have cashed, that, yeah, the two bottom teams would face off and it would end in a draw. The final question of the episode from Graham Freche concerns this game. After the worst teams in the league fought it out, who actually is the worst team? On the paper, it looked like Vegalta pretty much should have won it. So, I don't know. What do you reckon, Sam? They did have to come from 2-0 down inside the last 10 minutes. So, was Graham Freche on the money there? Did either team deserve it here?
I'd vote a draw for both the worst team. They were both awful. I mean, the defending from both teams in this game was so bad. I mean, just players being left unmarked from corners. Just, it was always going to end in a draw one way or the other, just because it doesn't benefit either team. Maybe at the end, by the looks of the play, I mean, Sendai were the one pushing towards the end. But in the reverse situation, if Vegalta had went 2-0 up, I'd have expected Yokohama to have found a way back into it, because Vegalta would have allowed them to come into the game. I just think it was quite an exciting game for what it was, but it was two very ordinary teams. And yeah, I mean, maybe give it Yokohama the wooden spoon at the moment, but yeah, both teams will be vying for that at the end of the season.
Yeah, so Dan, we all expect Gumba to start bucking up their ideas fairly sharpish. We hope for Gumba's supporters' sakes that they do, obviously with games in hand to come later on in the season. And we've just mentioned Oita now with six straight defeats of their own. So when you throw in Vegalta and Yokohama FC, it does appear, doesn't it, that these bottom three now might end up, they're definitely in danger of being cut adrift, and if that's the case, then it'll be a race to avoid being the fourth worst team in the league. But it does look pretty grim down there, doesn't it?
I'm reminded of that line from Billy Madison, I award you no points, may God have mercy on your soul. And that's sort of how you feel watching some of these teams at the moment. It's going to be tough. I don't know who. I guess it's easy to sort of think about who you consider the four worst teams in the J1. The real question is, who do you consider the fifth worst team? Who is just good enough to stay up? And I feel like Sapporo should be higher than 16th. Yeah, so I think maybe your fifth worst at the moment is either Belmare or Shimizu, just based on performance. Well, again, I think that they both have higher ceilings than they're currently at. But I don't know. I think that if I was a betting man, and I'm not, and if you're going to make financial decisions based on anything I say or tweet, stop. It is very hard to imagine Yokohama and Vegalta getting out of the drop zone. And I say this as someone who believed that Tegura Mori would be able to turn things around up at Sendai.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a very long season, it looks like, for Vegalta and indeed the Yokohama FC. I guess, at the end of the day, both spurning golden opportunities to take 3 points, a precious 3 points, a first win of the season. But as I said, at kickoff of the weekend, probably a draw in this game was one of the few things you could count on. All right, well, match day 10 is in the books. Again, the fixture list is all up in the air, with some teams having played as many as 12 games and Gumba only 6 so far. So the table is very fluid at the moment. And, a team like Antlers, who have just sacked their coach, have, 3 games in hand on the fourth place at Ezo Osaka, who they trail by 9 points. So, I mean, obviously things can be made up in quick time with teams having games in hand, etc., etc. So, match day 11, as we've mentioned a couple of times already, begins on Thursday the 22nd when Nagoya host Gumba. But, listeners, we thought we might give a new segment a try. A couple of weeks ago, Sam mentioned that, the Ricardo Rodriguez derby might be an entertaining watch for a neutral. So I've asked Sam to pick out his game of the week from the weekend's fixture list. This is something we don't usually do, of course. We're a review podcast rather than a preview one. But, yeah, Sam, maybe an international listener who might be new to the J-League and is able to check out a game on either Saturday or Sunday this week. Which game would you nudge them in the direction of?
Before we start, I just want to say I have in my head predicted the game that Sam is going to predict. So let's see if I'm right on the Guess Sam's Prediction game.
Oh, goodness me, what a segment that is. but yeah, my pick, I think the Yokohama Derby is one, yeah, it could be quite interesting, but I think it's probably a foregone conclusion, really. But I'm going to go with Kashima versus Vissel Kobe. I think on paper it seems the most interesting to me. Kobe have had a little bit of a slip in the last few games, but they're welcoming players back, and Masika might be able to get a start in this one. I think Lincoln is now in Kobe as well, so you might be able to get to see him in action. Kashima's players are in there as well, a new manager as well. They're trying to kind of rescue their season. I think it's a really intriguing game on paper, and both teams, if playing to their full potential, can play out a very interesting, exciting game. So, and it's a nice time as well for our European viewers, at 9 a.m. UK kickoff time. So that would be the game I'd be most interested in. Did you win, Dan?
No, I did not, actually. I thought you were going to go for Tokyo Tosu, which would, I think, like, it has been a consistently interesting fixture, for better or for worse, quite frequently for worse for Tokyo fans over the last few seasons. I especially the way Tosu are playing, I think if they come to Ajinomoto with the way that they performed against Nagoya, then I think it's going to be a real interesting match. But I don't argue with your selection.
All right. Well, those two games are two of the six that are being played on Saturday. Tokyo hosted Tosu at 2 o'clock and Kashima hosted Kobe at 5. Then we have two games on Sunday as well, with, of course, Kawasaki and Cerezo having the weekend off after they played their match day 11 game in midweek between match days 1 and 2. So, Frontale can put their feet up because looming on the horizon is, of course, the double header between the top two, with Nagoya hosting Kawasaki in the first leg, in inverted commas, on Thursday, the 29th of April. I think I said in last week's episode it was early in May, but, of course, that is the second fixture between the top two in J1. That game on the 29th has been brought forward from match day 22, and the return clash is slated, well, as originally scheduled, for Tuesday, the 4th of May at Todoroki. So we will have previews of obviously the Nagoya Kawasaki game coming in next week's episode, and then, well, it is a double banger, so we'll be all over both of those games, no question at all. And I don't know, Dan, while we've got you here, I might as well ask you about this as well. I mean, they've got to move fixtures around, we know, for the ACL. We know that Nagoya and Kawasaki are two of the ACL teams, but could they have done a better job of choosing a different fixture, perhaps, rather than having, and whether they're the top two in J1 probably doesn't mean anything for the fixture computer at J-League House, I understand, but surely a human being has got to look at this and say, we might be killing the season off by the first week of May here. I mean, if Kawasaki win both of these games, if they both win, well, Kawasaki's not going to win over the weekend, but if Nagoya win on the weekend, they'll be 3 points behind Frontale. But then if Frontale win the two games between these two teams, it'll be 9 points the difference. And can you see Frontale dropping 9 points for the rest of the season? I probably can't. So, people are saying that they might have killed the league off by the first week of May.
I don't, when it comes to this, you really don't know until you play the games, first of all. But, it's tough. I don't think that there is a solution that will make everyone happy. especially given that the league has had to go and, you know, reschedule things multiple times because of the ACL. They have to deal with the availability of venues. Nagoya obviously only have Toyota Stadium this season. Kawasaki have to work with the restrictions in terms of Todoroki during the Olympics, if I'm not mistaken, because I think that Todoroki will still be used as a training ground for someone. And it's... it is what it is. I don't think that the season is going to end as quickly as it could. But, you know, of course, I say that now. If Kawasaki continue to go on and win 13 in a row like they did last season, then it's a foregone conclusion anyway. So, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. I just don't have a better solution.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, any Nagoya players listening might want to pin this on their dressing room wall, as I've basically conceded that they're going to lose both of these games. Not that you can pin an audio podcast on your dressing room wall, but they might have it playing in the background. I don't know, but for motivation. But yeah, I mean, you know, you could have picked a game against Cerezo or Gamba for Nagoya to play. Well, they couldn't play Gamba in back-to-back weeks, and I'm getting confused myself. But I mean, it's just a shame that it has to be like this, I suppose, that these two games come in such quick succession after we were looking forward to the Todoroki meeting basically from the first month of the season, weren't we, Sam? We were already eyeing it off in the distance as these two teams reeled off unbeaten runs, and then to have them both played basically back-to-back is it's going to be fascinating to watch for these two games, but you worry that it might take the sting out of the rest of the league, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it will be fascinating, but yeah, you always want these big games kind of spread out. The second one, I think, would lose a little bit in this series. It's a shame, but we spoke about it, I think, a bit last week. But yeah, I hope for the league. As I've always said on this, I'm a neutral. I don't care who wins the league, but I kind of hope that Frontale don't win the two, because putting themselves 9 points, or it could be 12 points, ahead of Nagoya at this stage of the season, I mean, they'd probably demoralise Nagoya a little bit in terms of a title challenge, and they are the most realistic one, because the gap at the moment between Kawasaki and third and fourth is, 12 points at the moment, and yeah, you don't want, for a competitive league, you don't want that to get kind of out of hand this early in the season.
Yeah, and you certainly don't want that for Graham Frecce's state of mind. So, yeah, we hope that, at least one of these games goes in Nagoya's favour for his sake anyway. And indeed, for the competitive balance of the league, whether that's the right phrase or not, I don't know. But anyway, we've done the business again this week, gentlemen. Dan, always great to get your thoughts on obviously some wider issues around the Japanese game, but also, goings on the pitch in the top flight. So thanks very much for joining us again. Listeners, of course, you can check Dan out on Twitter at Aishiteru Tokyo, but I'm sure you're doing that already. And Dan, just one final thing. How would Ernst Tanner do in the J-League?
How would Ernst Tanner do in the J-League? What a question. He is, for those of you who don't know, the sporting director of the Philadelphia Union, my beloved MLS team. And he's taken a team in a city. You know, they don't have a huge budget, but they've managed to turn their academy into a star producing dynamo, and taken a lot of players, who aren't super expensive, and gone on and won the Supporters' Shield last year, and have gotten into the quarterfinals of the CONCACAF Champions League in their first appearance. So I think that Tanner, as a sporting director, he would do pretty well in the J-League. That is a guy who is well-prepared to deal with competitive balance, and you think about how balanced the league is already. You know, he's someone who can work miracles with not a lot of resources, so I say bring him on.
All right, well, thanks to Brian Smith for his question from Patreon. He's semi-serious, that's Brian's own words, question about Ernst Tanner. So thanks, Brian, for that. And Dan, once again, thanks very much for your time on this week's episode.
Absolutely. Well, the chaos era is alive and well, and we are all witnesses.
Yes, indeed. No question about that. All right, Sam. Yeah, terrific stuff. So, yeah, another big weekend, although, of course, the leaders are not in action. But, yeah, we'll be wrapping up match day 11, but then looking ahead to the big blockbuster between the top two to come the following midweek. So, yeah, look forward to doing it all again next week with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope my picked game doesn't turn out to be a dross nil-nil. So, yeah, it should do well. And then I've got the Levain Cup that we're all excited for through midweek to keep us all entertained. So, yeah, let's get through that and look forward to another weekend next week.
All right, and that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would very much like to thank Dan Olowitz for his time on this week's episode. We'd like to thank Graham Freche, Johnny Nicol, Gabrielle Anello, and Brian Smith for their questions via Patreon, and indeed all of our patrons for their ongoing support of the podcast. We'd also like to thank you listeners for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 11. Speak to you next week. Bye for now. But a late Sendai fight back saw the shares
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes.